So I thought I'd continue our rambling conversation about the one who's not busy. And I have this quotation from Shogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, the famous Tibetan Lama who flamed his way through the Dharma galaxies of the West in a brilliant light that ended in about sometime in the late 80s or so. And somebody asked him, how is it possible to work at a rate of speed and still have sanity about it? And he answered this, well, it's overall view. When you are being hassled, you are reduced into a pinpoint, traditionally. You begin to become so small that you are hassled by the giant situations that begin to close in on you. You are afraid about your timetable, scheduling, and everything. Whereas, if you take a greater view at that point, then you are no longer small. You can cover a lot of areas. You can extend your tentacles greater that way, so that you have some sort of stronghold, or at least some kind of clear vision of where you're coming from. You're not just being bounced back and forth like a ping-pong ball by the mercy of the situation. I guess he means at the mercy of your situation on the ping-pong table. When you're hassled, there's a tendency to become small. So the opposite approach, in this case, is like taming and entering. When you're hassled, you have to become bigger, so you can't be bounced around. So that's what he said. Which, of course, raises the question, how do you become bigger? Well, if you think about it, there seems to be a limit to how big we can become if we start with our present self and try to expand it and make it bigger, you know, by degrees. It seems that there's a severe limit to how much that can be done. And in a way, this is what we are usually trying to do, isn't it? I would like to be bigger. I would like to have more, do more, know more, be more helpful. I would like to put my stamp on everything, on as many things as I possibly can in this lifetime. So we've been trying to make ourselves bigger, and it's not working. And this is exactly why we're so busy. So it must be that what he means by becoming bigger in a sustainable way is something other than this. It's got to be something radically, radically different from this. One of the most profound and beautiful practices in Mahayana Buddhism is the practice of exchanging self and others. You flip around, you know. Others are myself, and myself is others. You flip it around. And you recognize, through doing this practice, that how narrow-minded it is to think of oneself as being limited by the skin. The outside, the skin, is the limit of oneself. This is a very narrow-minded viewpoint, that only what's within this skin is me, within the thoughts spinning around in my brain, within the limited range of experiences that I apparently have had in my lifetime. That's myself. You see right away when you practice exchanging self and others that the self also must include what seems to be beyond the self when we encounter another. At that time, you know, that other person fills our whole self. And we are that person at that time. And the relationship that we've made together in that encounter is also ourself. And the space around the body is also ourself. And this is literally so. It's not as if, you know, there is I mean, the molecules on the edge of our skin and the molecules in the air around our skin are literally mixing up together. So we aren't limited by our skin. And the self doesn't end with the skin. The self includes the space around the body and the space connected to that space all the way up to the stars. The space in which we're all living together as one self, the whole earth, the whole sky. And, you know, we know this, although we forget it. And you can tell because of the funny quirk that if you say, I'm going to leave in a few hours, if I say that, I seem to be referring to this person. But if Vicky, is that your name? If Vicky says, she's going to also be gone in a few hours, she says the same thing. She says, I'm going to be gone in a few hours. Well, wait a minute, I thought I was I. How come you get to be I? Well, you're I too. It's strange, isn't it? Or me. I'm my me and you're me, but the me is the same me. It's strange. Our speech, you know, tells us that there's one subjectivity. Otherwise we wouldn't, every language has these things. We have individual names, but if we're more, we don't call ourselves by our own names. We call ourselves I, but everybody else calls themselves I as well. Because we understand we share the same subjectivity. Subjectivity is not chopped up into various atomized ones. So this is how we make ourselves bigger. We can literally shift the ground of our identity. So that instead of seeing this body and mind as the sum total of what we really are, we recognize that the entire range of what we all are, the entire range of space and time, is connected to us. This is the realm of our true identity. And then we are much bigger. Much, much bigger. So we don't need to be intimidated by the world and its demands when we understand our real dimensions. Suppose I fail to communicate as I would like to in a timely way, consistently, with the people who are dearest to me, the people who want me to communicate with them and feel that they need me to communicate with them. Suppose I fail in that job. Of course, I don't want to fail in that job. I want to do my best to communicate with them and to satisfy their need. And I want them to be happy. And I especially don't want them to be disappointed in me. That would make me, you know, really sad if they were disappointed in me. But suppose I fail in that. Suppose I fail them and they are disappointed in me. Well, if that happens, then that'll be okay. Then they'll learn self-reliance. They'll learn that it was a bad idea for them to have depended on me. It was really bad for them. And if they get really angry with me, that'll be good for them. They'll learn how to work with anger. They'll learn how to deal with anger, and if they learn that, I will have given them a great gift, you know, by getting them angry with me. If they can really learn how to overcome anger and see through anger. And if they're angry at me, and I feel bad about that, then I can learn to overcome my feelings of, you know, feeling badly when someone's angry with me. I better let go when someone is angry with me, you know, and not, I can feel some regret for having failed, but I need to learn how to withstand that, and that would be good for me. So definitely, you know, I'm going to try my best, and I have been, and I'll try a little harder. And definitely, I don't want to fail at this. But I know that if I do fail, that will also be good, you see? That will also work to the benefit of myself and others. That's part of what I need. If I fail, I'll get that from my failure, and so will they. And so this is always true, you know, for all of us. We're afraid of failing, you know, we're afraid of screwing up. And yeah, we try not to, for sure. We try our best. But if we realize that, well, if we screw up, that'll be good too. Might even be better. Then, you know, we're not so driven. We're not so worried about it. And there's no contradiction between realizing that and trying our best. What are we afraid of in the end? We feel like we're small, and we're afraid of becoming even smaller. I want to succeed. I don't want to fail, because if I fail, I'll be smaller. But if I knew how big I really was, how would I be afraid of failing? How could I possibly be any smaller? We lose, in the end, everything, anyway, maybe. But that's just an illusion. Because what did we ever actually have to begin with? Did we ever have anything to lose? You know, the things we possess, do we possess those things? Are they actually ours? Or do they possess us? We say, I own a house. But if you own a house, you realize that this is not true. I feel bigger, I own a house, but it's not true. If I lose my house, I'll be smaller, but that's not true. Actually, the house owns me. I don't own the house. I'm working for the house. I'm literally working night and day for the house. When it falls down, who fixes it up? Me. I don't do it myself, but I have to pay someone to do it. I'm responsible for that. If the house demands things, I'm the one who has to feed the house the things that it demands, pay the taxes. And when I die, you know, the house isn't going to care. The house won't come to my funeral. The house is going to be serenely continuing in its way, looking for someone else that it can own. So if I lose, you know, my house, what have I lost? Have I become smaller? Not really. So we're afraid of, you know, losing something because we'll be smaller, but total loss is total freedom. And we're all large enough to embrace total loss. We already have embraced total loss. And instead of fearing this, why don't we just take a joyful leap into total loss and soar through? In my Dharma seminar at home recently, we were studying Prajnaparamita, an 8,000 line sutra. And at the end of the sutra, there's this wonderful passage where this bodhisattva is looking. He wants to study Sataprurudita. He wants to study the Prajnaparamita, and he's looking around for a great teacher that he can study with, and he can't find anybody. And all of a sudden, a voice comes out of the sky and says, you know, go west. So he says, okay, and he starts going west, and he's going and going, and all of a sudden he realizes that he doesn't know, the voice failed to tell him, you know, how far west to go. So he doesn't know what to do, so he stops in his tracks, he starts crying. And he's crying and crying because he doesn't know how far west to go. And then a Buddha appears to him and tells him where to go. And he goes to this place. And the Buddha has told him to seek out this teacher by the name of Dharmodgata. And he finally finds Dharmodgata. And it turns out that Dharmodgata is living in this fabulous palace with, full of jewels. And, you know, the kind of palace you can only find in an Indian text. Jewels and, you know, lapis lazuli, a library with books printed on gold leaf in lapis lazuli ink. A harem of wives, you know, and all this. And it says in the sutra that he spends half a day every day enjoying all of these luxuries, and the other half a day preaching the Prajnaparamita, the emptiness of all dharmas. So Sataprutta goes to him and studies the emptiness of all dharmas. I think the Theravada tradition and the Zen tradition share a kind of taste for simplicity and spare living. And the Vajrayana, the tradition represented by Trungpa Rinpoche, is much more flamboyant and emphasizes excess. So I appreciate the simple style of Zen and Theravada Buddhism. It comes from the monastic tradition to live simply without much extra. But also, we can mistake that style for a kind of smallness. It isn't really a smallness. And so it's good to be informed by the Vajrayana spirit. So we can do a lot of things, like organizing parties for our friends. This is a great thing to do, you know. If you're busy organizing a party for your friends, this is not a bad thing to do. This is a great idea. So if it's somebody's wedding anniversary or birthday or something like that, it's a great idea to go all out and make a big party for them and invite everyone and have a great celebration. And if we're doing that, you know, out of love for someone, then we're not too busy. This is not too stressful. Because it's done with a great delight and a great love. And if we can do that, seeing the empty nature of all things, so much the better. More joy, more delight in the total loss that is in the middle of everything all the time. Then we can do the things we do, even if there are many, many things, with a tremendous sense of joy and expansiveness. It's a great thing to exercise our life energy to the fullest in celebration and in love, to share as much as we possibly can of our good feeling for one another, to offer as much as we can to others. This is a great thing. And we're never too busy, you know, when we're doing that. And if we have that spirit, there's absolutely nothing to worry about. I mean, we could get into the idea that I'm making a party, I'm making a party for my in-laws. If the party comes off, I'm a hero. If the party's a dud, I'm an idiot. And now I'm nervous. But if I'm just out of the goodness of my spirit doing this, if it comes off great, fabulous. If it comes off a dud, whoops. Okay, well, we tried. And anyway, with that spirit, how could it ever not come out? Right? The only way that it would not come out is if one's own spirit in the process is deflated. But if you are feeling joyful in the effort, how does it not come off perfectly well? Anything, success or failure, how does it not come off perfectly well if that's your spirit? when we know our own largeness, we can hold everything. And everything always works out, even when it doesn't. I thought I would share a few more stories about... I love to tell the Zen stories in the Vipassana community. At the Zen retreats, I hardly ever tell them, you know, but I love to share them here, so I'll tell you a few more. This is another story about Yunyan and Dawu, the same two brothers that have the story about too busy. Yunyan asks, why does the Bodhisattva Guanyin have so many hands and eyes? And do you know about the Bodhisattva Guanyin, the Bodhisattva of compassion? maybe you have heard of, or maybe you haven't heard of, the legend of Guanyin, who, you know, she receives the cries of the world. She hears, in some versions she sees the suffering of the world, in other versions she hears the cries of the world. And one day, and she cares, and one day, and I think we can all relate to this, one day she so much took in the cries of the world that her head exploded. So you can all relate to this, right? I think you understand this. However, as in line with what I'm saying here, being a very large bodhisattva, it's not that much of a problem when her head explodes, as it might be for us if we identified in a very small scale. Bodhisattvas can have their heads exploded, and it's a good thing. So the result of the explosion of Guanyin's head is that she grew multiple heads, replaced the one head. And multiple arms replaced the one set of arms. So sometimes you see statues of Guanyin with 13 or 25 heads, which stand for an infinite number of heads, and 13 or 25 sets of arms, which stands for an infinite number of arms. So Guanyin has many, many hands and eyes because of all the heads and all the sets of arms. So this is the question. How come the Bodhisattva Guanyin has so many hands and eyes? And Dawu replies, it's like reaching back for your pillow in the dark. In other words, compassion is a natural thing. It's not complicated. It's not a big deal. Look how compassionate I'm being, you know. It's as natural as in the middle of the night when you're sleeping, you reach back for your pillow and adjust it if it's not adjusted properly. And you do it without even thinking about it. And you don't say, what a nice guy I am. You know? Look at how I'm adjusting my pillow to suit my poor head. I'm such a compassionate person, you know. One doesn't say that, you know, one just does it. So compassion is like that. That's the idea. So Yunyan says, I understand. And Dawu says, okay, what do you understand? Being the elder brother, you know, he's not going to just pat him on the back. He says, okay, what do you understand? And Yunyan says, the whole body is covered with hands and eyes. And Dawu says, well, that's almost it. So Yunyan says, well, what do you say? And Dawu replies, there's nothing but hands and eyes. So this little story is telling us that there's nothing but compassion. There's nothing but love. There are no boundaries. There are no small beings who depend on success and failure for their happiness. There's nothing but love, the kind of love that accepts everything, that accepts suffering to say, as we usually do, out of our smallness, that compassion is this extra thing on top of reality. This is nice and it's admirable, but it just doesn't go far enough. And we end up suffering for the smallness of it. It's exhausting, you know, to see suffering and feel like we have to be compassionate. This is exhausting. Our head could explode. In the suffering itself is the compassion. In the reality itself is the compassion. In being with our life as it is nothing but compassion, nothing but love. And this is, you know, we can apply this to our theme of being busy or not busy. It's exhausting to be busy and have to do a lot of stuff, you know. But everything is already being done. Everything is already doing. The 60,000 miles of blood vessels in our body are doing their work all the time. We don't have to make that happen. In the process of saving beings from suffering, is underway. We don't have to make it happen. Of course, out of the boundless spaciousness of our hearts, we want to be giving and loving, and we should do that. But not with the pressure of thinking that we have to be compassionate. It's already compassion. It's already there. We already are compassion. Suffering is already undergoing its healing. So there's nothing to be busy about. There's no pressure to be feeling. I was thinking, you know, it's hard to imagine like the Buddha being too busy. You don't think of the Buddha being busy. There's a famous story about, you know, Angulimala, the serial killer, you know, who became a disciple of the Buddha. You probably know this story, but without telling the whole story, one of the astonishing things about the story is that the Buddha is walking along. Angulimala decides he's going to kill the Buddha. So the Buddha is walking along peacefully, doing walking meditation as he always did. So Angulimala figures this guy will be easy to catch and kill. So he starts running really fast, but he can't catch up to the Buddha. The Buddha doesn't go any faster, he's going the same pace, but no matter how fast Angulimala runs, he can't catch up to the Buddha. Because the Buddha never hurries, and yet you can't catch him. So this is one of the features of that story. So it's hard to imagine the Buddha being like stressed out. You know, you think of the Buddha being very peaceful. And then you think, well, but that was the Buddha. And anyway, of course he was peaceful. He was living in ancient India. And he was a renunciate. He didn't have a house and a family. He didn't have a job. We might be in awe of the Buddha. Or we might say, yeah, if he had my life, he'd be just as stressed out as I am. He didn't have to deal with that. You know? And then we might think, and if I was a renunciate too, I'd be like that too. Unfortunately, I have this burden I have to take care of, and so I'll never be able to get out from under it. Well, it's true, you know, the Buddha was a renunciate monk. And we think of renunciation as being, you know, giving up coffee or something. You know? The Buddha gave up coffee. But I actually don't think that the Buddha was a renunciate because he gave up coffee. I think the Buddha was a renunciate because he gave up confused human conceptual framework. He renounced the confused human conceptual framework that makes us feel too busy, makes us feel stressed out, makes us feel too small and inadequate. The human conceptual framework that tells us that we're vulnerable, tiny human beings standing over against a menacing, frightening world. That's what the Buddha renounced. They call the Buddha, you know, one of the epithets for the Buddha is the deathless one. And they say that the Buddha conquered death. Did you know that? The Buddha never died. He conquered death. Well, wait a minute. Isn't there the Parinirvana Sutra where the Buddha lies down between the two solid trees and passes out of this life? Yes? But that's not called death. That's called Parinirvana. Because the only way you can die is if you identify with the smallness of the self inside the skin. That's the only way you can die. If that's what you are, then yes, there's death, and it's painful and difficult. But if you're large, the largeness exactly is defined by including all coming and going. So the Buddha entered Parinirvana. He didn't enter death. So in this way, I think we also can be renunciates if we want to be. It's not a matter of whether we wear a robe or own something or don't own something. It's a matter of what do we think we're doing? Who do we think we are? If we own our house and realize, oh, this is just a convention. I don't really own this house. Then we can renounce our house, even while we still live in it. So it's possible. I think it's necessary even for us to find a way to renounce the conceptual framework that causes us so much grief, so much stress, so much busyness. Speaking of birth and death, here's another story about. This one is about Dawu, but not with his brother Yunyan, but this time Dawu with his disciple. So Dawu and his disciple go to a funeral, and the disciple knocks on the coffin, and he says, "Alive or dead?" to the corpse inside the coffin. And Dawu says, "I won't say." What is life? What is death? Is the person in the coffin dead or alive? Are we dead or alive? That's what the disciple wants to know. And Dawu says, "I won't say." So they leave, and the disciple is very agitated about this and demands that Dawu answer his question, alive or dead, alive or dead. And Dawu says, "I won't say." And the disciple says, "You better say or I'm going to beat you up." So Dawu says, "I won't say." And he beats him up. And Dawu says, "Well, I don't mind so much. But, you know, it's the cardinal rule of the monastery is that you don't beat up the teacher. So remember this if you ever go to a monastery. Do not beat up the teacher. It's a bad thing. You get kicked out of the monastery for doing that." So Dawu says, "You know, you might as well not even go back because you're going to get kicked out anyway and plus be humiliated. So just go." And he does. He goes. And he goes away for many years, and many years later he comes back to the monastery, and Dawu has died. And he says to the new abbot of the monastery, "Alive or dead?" He reads the whole story. He says, "Alive or dead?" And the new abbot says, "I won't say." And this time the disciple understands and is illuminated by the same answer. So do we really know what is life and what is death? Does our small conceptual framework in which we think that we're alive and others are dead and later will be dead, does this really tell us what's going on? life is not what we think it is, and death is not what we think it is. And when we are willing in our practice to fully give ourselves without leaving anything behind, fully give ourselves to the silence that's in the middle of every breath, in the middle of every sound, in the middle of every sensation, in the middle of every word, every phrase, every desire, then we will be willing to let go, to renounce our conceptual frameworks. We'll be willing to die to knowledge, die to control, die to desire. To be willing to really live every moment means to be willing to give up every moment, right? You can't hold on to any moment. That's the nature of time. The only way you can really give yourself to your practice on your cushion is to be willing to renounce everything in that moment. That's what it means to really be alive, is to be willing to let go and die to every moment. And this is what's going on, whether we cooperate with it or not, it's what's going on moment after moment. We are dying to each moment. You know, you can never get a moment back. All the tea in China, you know, could not buy back a moment of time. How did we think we were too busy in this world of time? How did we reduce time to this little limited container that we're trying to fill up with a bunch of stuff? Whenever we think we're too busy, whenever we're stressed out, whenever we're overwhelmed, it's because we forgot who we are and what is going on. Another Zen teacher, Guishan, one time asked Da Wu, where are you coming from? And Da Wu said, I come from tending the sick. And Guishan said, how many people were sick? And Da Wu said, there were the sick and the not sick. And Guishan said, aren't you the one who's not sick? And Da Wu said, being sick and not being sick have nothing to do with the true person. So it seems as if Da Wu had the practice of visiting the sick, which is one of the great spiritual practices. If you don't have this, you know, we think we should be nice and visit the sick, and of course we should. But did you ever think that visiting the sick was a spiritual practice just as efficacious for awakening as coming to a meditation retreat? So that we should, you know, approach that the same way that we would approach coming to a retreat. This is good, we should do this, this has been helpful for my life, for my practice. It's not just I'm selflessly doing some compassionate thing for somebody else. It's a practice, it's a spiritual practice to visit the sick. And I try to do this practice as much as I can, and I'm always falling down on the job. It's my great regret, you know, I'm not able to do this as well as I would like to. If you want to read something very moving, you should read Specimen Days. I was reading this recently, Walt Whitman's diary of his time during the Civil War. He quit everything he was doing and moved to Washington, and every day spent his whole day at a hospital tending the sick from the war. And that would be a great thing to do. But maybe Da Wu was not visiting the sick. In Zen, you know, the question, where are you coming from, is always a very large question. It doesn't just mean literally, you know, where were you just a minute ago? So when Da Wu said, I've come from tending the sick, he may have meant something by this very profound. Actually, on any occasion, we could answer the same way. Imagine if we saw that. What are you doing? I'm tending the sick. This is what we're always doing. We're tending the sick. Isn't this what the first noble truth of Buddhism amounts to? All conditioned existence is by its nature dukkha, suffering, sick. To be alive is to basically be walking around with a terminal illness, right? That you could say that's the definition of life. Is life is basically a terminal illness. It would be funny if you know, doctors would write this on the death certificate: cause of death, life, because that actually is the cause of death. All other causes of death are incidental. It'd be like, you know, a cause of death, a mosquito bite. Well, it wasn't the mosquito bite. Actually, the person had a mosquito bite just before they died, but it was actually the cancer that caused it, not the mosquito bite. Well, it actually wasn't the cancer either. It was life. Because as soon as they were born, they were doomed. What, you know, what's the difference? They got cancer, they got a mosquito bite, they got this, they got that. That's the cause of death. So we're all sick. So whatever we're doing, we're actually tending the sick. So Dawu says, when he's asked, he says, there are the sick and there are the not sick. So who are the ones who are sick? The ones who are sick are the ones who have forgotten the true story of our lives. They've forgotten the all-pervasive nature of suffering and pain. They think that they're not sick, and they're surprised when they encounter suffering or loss. Why did that happen? That wasn't supposed to happen. Those are the people who are sick. Who are the ones who are not sick? They're the ones who know that they're sick. That's why they're not sick, because they know their condition. They know that we're all in the same boat, that there are no boundaries between each of us, and there's a sympathy. They have a sympathy for everything and everyone. They know that life is a matter of helping one another, tending the sick all the time. And when they know this from their heart and their whole heart, and they live this out, they're not sick. In the end, as Dawu says, the true person is beyond sick and not sick. The true person is just the person who is. And is, being, is time. And time includes coming and going, living and dying equally. That's what time is. That's what we are. And the true person inside of us, you know, is beyond being sick and not being sick. And that's the person, as I was saying this morning when we started our day, that's the person that we're returning to when we turn to our breath, when we return to the feeling in the body. And just whatever is there in the mind, we let it come and go, and we don't fix on it and identify with it and grasp it. So that's what our practice is, really. It's just the practice of returning to the one who's not busy, the true person, and the real person that we have always been, coming home to that person. That's really what we're doing. We're not grinding away trying to improve our minds, you know, although we might think so. Really, it's not that. It's really just coming home. So, I guess I want to suggest in conclusion here that you extend your practice. Think about extending your practice to your whole life, not just the time of retreat or the time of meditation. That you practice walking meditation all the time. That you practice coming back to your breath whenever you think of it. That you use, we talked the other day about phrases, you know, meditating on a phrase, not busy, tending the sick, simultaneous inclusion. Remember we talked about that? Inclusion. So if any of these words that we used this weekend struck you, you know, inclusion, not busy, tending the sick, write them down on a card, you know, and look at them and remember them and bring them to your breath and bring them to your heart. And do that in your meditation practice and then use them during the day. Train your mind and your heart to come back all the time to who you really are, what you really are, and what your purpose really is. And realize that you can be how easy it is to be trapped in a whole conceptual framework that just isn't necessarily so. And that liberation is not necessarily changing the details of your life as much as it is changing the way you understand your life and the way you inhabit it. So please, whatever you heard in this weekend that will help you to practice that, I hope you will. In your Sangha, you have the practice, I think, of speaking to one another, right? You do that a lot. Because I remember last time, not this time, but last time I was talking, saw Rodney, we were talking about this, and we had both made this discovery, independently of each other. And probably a lot of other Dharma people have also made this discovery, how important it is that we not only listen to teachings as in the tradition, but that we also express ourselves, express our understanding of the teaching, and that we do that intimately with one another in a safe space is a really important part of the practice. And so I do this all the time in my practice at home, and I think, I'm pretty sure Roddy said, yeah, so we do that too. How do you like that? You know, we were amazed. We both thought we were so smart, you know. Oh, we figured this thing out. So now I'm assuming that probably 10,000 other people figured this thing out too. All good ideas are usually 10,000 people know them at the same time. So let's do that now. Let's find a way to talk about what we shared together this weekend. So before I suggest something for us to talk about, let's just switch our seats around so that everybody has a partner. Let's just talk with one person. So find someone to talk to, one-on-one, and move your seats around and face someone. Now, does everybody have one partner? Is there anybody extra left over? So there's one extra person over here. Is there anybody else in the room who's extra? So just one person, right? Okay, why don't you come over and you and I will be partners. Okay? So everybody has one partner to talk to. Okay, so let me, I don't know exactly how you practice this in your Sangha, but let me explain the way that I do it. And I no doubt it'll be exactly the same way that you do it. Probably just explained in slightly different words. So the idea is that, first of all, I hope everybody will agree to confidentiality. That you won't repeat what you hear, even to the person who spoke it, that we'll forget about it. It will certainly influence all of us. What we hear will influence all of us, and it will change our hearts, but we won't repeat it. unless the person asks. Remember what I said, what did you think later? If they ask, then it's okay, but you won't even suggest it to them unless they ask you, okay? Can we agree to that? Because that's a very important, because this has to be obviously a safe place that we can agree to that, so that everybody can speak as honestly as possible. Usually when we talk, whether we consciously intend it or not, we're kind of trying to make ourselves look as good as possible. You know, when we say things we say, don't we usually do that? We try to make ourselves look like pretty noble individuals. But and we may be also noble individuals and also not at the same time. So that we should feel free to actually be as honest as possible here, knowing that everybody, that our listeners understand, and they're just like us. So, confidentiality. And secondly, these are not really conversations, they're monologues. So each person is going to get 5 minutes to speak. And in the 5 minutes, the other person won't ask any questions, won't ask for clarification. The other person will just practice listening to you. And that means coming to the body and the breath and really fully taking in what the other person is saying without thinking about how that compares to what you're going to say or whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, what they're saying, but just completely taking it in. And you'll have the full 5 minutes. And if you run out of things to say, then you can both just be silent. You might think of something, you know, later. So each person will get the full 5 minutes to speak without interruption in an atmosphere in which you're listened to with full acceptance. And that's a rare thing. You know, a lot of people don't have that experience, so this is a beautiful thing. It's beautiful to listen to another human being with full acceptance, and it's beautiful to speak and be listened to in that spirit. So we'll begin. I'll strike the bell and we'll begin with silence for a moment, just a moment or two, a few breaths, and then I'll strike the bell a second time, and whoever wants to go first, it doesn't make any difference, can begin to speak, and I'll time it, and I'll strike the bell at the end of 5 minutes, and then that means the second person speaks, and then I'll strike the bell after that. So what are we going to talk about? You may ask. Yeah. So here's my suggestion, and I offer this only as a suggestion because if the field is too broad, it might be hard to think of where to start. So take this as a suggestion and feel free to take it in any way you want or talk about something different if it's important. So I thought since this weekend, starting with the open talk on Friday night and through the whole weekend, we've been talking about busyness and the one who's not busy. Talk about your relationship to this in your actual life. What's your relationship to being busy and not being busy? Are you too busy? And how does that work for you? Where does your, whatever your habit is in relation to being too busy or not too busy, where do you think that comes from? What's the conditioning in your life that produces this persistent attitude in you? And did you hear anything over the weekend that might change that for you? And if so, what did you hear, and how do you understand it? If there was something specific, you know, like this practice of returning to the breath or paying attention to walking, if there was something specific that you heard that you would like to resolve to do, then it would help you to say that out loud to the other person. I'm going to do this. That's different, you know. If you say that you're going to do something to another person, it's different than if you just sort of in your mind think so. So you don't have to say that, but if you feel like it, that might help. So that's the topic. You know, how are you with this question of being busy or not being busy? What's the conditioning behind your habitual way of relating to this? What have you heard, if anything, because maybe not, if anything over the weekend that changes your view of this? And if there's some technique that you would like to employ and you'd like to say so, then you can do that. So those are anything around that territory. Obviously, you don't have to hit all those points, but this gives you a lot of things to think about. So we'll begin with a bell, and the second bell begins the conversation. So this is for silence.